RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with royal designers.
I'm here at one of the bastions of British and world film production, Shepperton Studios, an unlikely collection of hangar-like buildings along with caravans, porter cabins, and at the heart of the complex is a delightful Victorian manor house, where I am about to meet my guest today. He is the man responsible for transferring J.K. Rowling's imaginings of the world of Harry Potter onto the screen. For over 10 years, art director Stuart Craig has been the driving force behind the look of all 8 Harry Potter film productions. And during that decade, he has evolved the fusion of physical and digital production design to astonishing heights. Nominated 9 times for the Oscar and recipient of 3 for his work on Gandhi, Dangerous Liaison, and The English Patient, Craig talks of his considerable success with great modesty. The fact is, his work on all of these productions speak for themselves. Join me now to hear his fascinating story.
Well, Stuart, we're sitting here in one of the boardrooms at Shepperton Studios, which obviously has a lot of cinematic history.
Indeed.
These walls have probably soaked up lots of interesting things over the 70 years or so. But I think just 30 years ago you were here making Elephant Man with David Lynch, is that
That's right. Yes. We did. He was 33 years old. I was probably 36, 37. The line producer was another young man in his mid-30s, young accountant, I remember. It was a very young crew on that film. And the immediate producer, Jonathan Sanger, an American producer, also a young man, probably, 35, 36. The father figure behind it all was a Brooks film, and Mel Brooks was the parent, really, and kept everybody in line. Very brave of him.
Him saying on an interview once that he went in to see Eraserhead and came out and said, "You're a madman, but a genius." And
then, yes.
And then worked with all this film. But yes. I distinctly remember that film because, I mean, it had a beautiful atmosphere, and I think a lot of that was to do with the cinematographer and the art direction, which was very sort of sombre.
Yes, it was, coupled
with all of the strange.
I mean, the black and white helped enormously.
Yes, of course. But that was an early, obviously, probably Lynch's first really major film.
I think Eraserhead was the only other known film before that. He had another project in his head called Ronnie Rocket, which I don't think he ever made. He went on and did Dune for Dino De Laurentiis immediately after that.
That's right.
It was an amazing time, actually, and a sort of a major stepping stone, first stepping stone for him, certainly, for all of us that hung on to his coattails, really.
Now, you're back here, so 30 years fast forward, you're back here and you're about to start on a new production. Is that secret, or are you allowed to say anything?
It is secret, but I'm going to be indiscreet enough to tell you that actually it's an extension of the Harry Potter thing. That was a 10-year franchise. They have a successful theme park, which I was involved as a kind of spin-off from the films, in Orlando, Florida. They want now to extend that theme park, so I'm working on a possible extension. Films are my business, really, and I'll get back to films as soon as this is done. But this is just a slight deviation. A few months in a different direction.
Oh, I see. Absolutely. Because I think you've just finished Gambit.
Yes.
Which is scripted by the Coen brothers.
Yes, indeed. Directed by Michael Hoffman.
That's right. So that's
good script.
I think that's still in post-production, or at least it's being finalised.
Yeah, we finished not much more than 6 weeks ago, maybe.
Right.
Very, very good script. Extremely good script.
So that
funny, and it's charming, and it has Colin Firth in it, Cameron Diaz in it, Tom Courtney, Alan Rickman.
Wow.
Someone can only imagine that it's really very good. I hope so.
Yes. That sort of really, I guess, prior to that, you had your 10-year stint on the Harry Potter films.
Yes.
Which I wonder whether you felt kind of a sense of liberation after that.
No, I did. And I very much wanted to do something different. and for, of a different scale, which Gambit was. Gambit was a comparatively low-budget film.
Yeah.
You know, 10-week shooting as against 26-week shooting or whatever the Bond, the Harry Potter films were. So it was. It was very modest. The budget was very modest. And it was good to just join the real world and the real world of films again, really, because there was slight unreality about the luxury we were afforded, really, on the Harry Potter films. They were so successful that you could actually, after the first one, you could pretty much afford to do anything you wished. And
really?
Well, it's not quite
sort true. Of.
Well, there's never enough money. For your dreams are always bigger than your purse, aren't they?
Yes.
Always, always. And
I
they were
so.
There.
Yes.
But when it really came down to it, there was a lot that, within our scope, really, lots of opportunity to get it absolutely right.
Yes. So I guess so. Your feet are sort of back on the ground a bit for a while.
Yeah. No, I think so. I think that's fair to say.
I think what would be good now is really to kind of pin down exactly what the art director does and is responsible for. For those listening that really are not quite sure, they may think, well,
yes.
dress the set or maybe you paint the scenery. What?
Yes.
Give me a...
Well, your responsibility is for the, it's a loose phrase, but the look of the film. What in fact that means, unlike theatre, there are very few designers, film designers, who design costume and film. Some do, but it's quite rare. So you're responsible for everything which isn't the actor, in effect. And that means the choice of locations, if you're shooting on location, the design and the building of the sets, if that indeed is what you're doing. And you must make sure, of course, that the costume designer, the lighting cameraman, those two, well, the camera operator too, you must make sure that they are your best friend and that you are, the collaboration is as full and as good as it can be, because, you know, it is a team game, really, frustratingly in some ways. I suppose had more autonomy, but when those relationships work, then it really is very satisfying, very good.
So the way I think it normally works is that there is a book or a script that has been purchased, and then the director may work on the script with the writer, and then who is brought in really next at the next stage? Would it be
the designer?
The designer
is a very early contributor, yes, because part of your responsibility is to not just to satisfy the director in terms of images and telling the story, but it's to find a practical way for the producer to make his film. So you have a responsibility to the producer as well, as I say, for that precise reason. There are, you know, locations versus sets, in these days, digital effects as opposed to physical sets, virtual worlds as opposed to physical worlds. There are many choices, and there's a budget, and so that's a, you know, considerable part of your work.
The sort of initial upfront budgeting, all of that, you would have to be responsible, obviously, with a team of people, but you have to sort of work out that sort of thing?
Often, and this is to be preferred too, the designer starts early enough that the budget doesn't exist in terms of any precise breakdown. I mean, there's an overall figure. There's a figure that the studio, the producer, has a figure in mind, often a very tight, firm figure. But nonetheless, it hasn't been apportioned yet. And part of the designer's job is to help in that apportioning of the money, you know, as I say, and our decisions about shooting on locations versus building sets. And
sure.
So it's quite,
so
you're a fairly
really,
extensive you're responsibility.
So you're right up there at the beginning, really.
Yes.
It's shaping.
Yes.
And then later the cinematographer obviously comes on board because, as you say, it's very important that they slot in with the vision that you've had, because obviously lighting a set can change it dramatically,
the whole
feel. And
the director's there from the very beginning,
of course.
Yeah. The director hires the designer,
with
the producer, but he does. And so everything goes through the filter of the director, the director's imagination, the director's needs.
Sure.
And so it's likely that, the cameraman and the designer end up in the same place, really, because
I guess with the Potter films, because you were there at the beginning and to the end, and there were many directors.
Yes.
There's only one of the directors, I think, directed two of them. He was the first one.
Chris Columbus directed the first two films.
Yes. And then it was
Alfonso Cuarón, the third film, Mike Newell, the fourth film.
So with something like that, how much autonomy do the directors have when something is existing already? They obviously want to move it on and add to it, but you're very rooted in the world of Potter.
I did say to each of them at the beginning, look, you don't have to have me. It may appear that you do, and in fact I'm very aware that it appears that you must have me, that I'm part of the furniture. But it actually was true to say they didn't have to have me. They could easily somebody would have taken it on, made some alterations, I'm sure, to what existed and just made it their own. But
I read somewhere that J.K. Rowling insisted that you were part of the furniture of Harry Potter. Is that not right?
I'm not sure. Not in my hearing, she did. when it came to the theme park, theme park in Orlando, I think she said then, I want this to look like the films.
So did you, you met her at the very beginning when this was being talked about, the whole idea?
Yes.
And so was that a sort of, meet and greet sort of setup?
Yeah, but met with a list. Met with a list of questions.
Yeah.
I'm not sure to what extent I was being vetted. Probably was, but it was a very sort of good working session, really. Lots of questions, and the one thing she did, I was concerned about the geography of the world, of the Hogwarts world, and so on. And she just took out a piece of A4 paper and drew a map of the world very, very quickly and competently, I have to say. Showing the station and the lake and the school and the fact that the first years had to go across the lake to the entrance of the school by boat, and everybody else had to take carriages drawn by thestrals around the ring road. all the information was there, and that stayed on my wall for 10 years, that drawing.
So did you keep that?
What I have is... What I have is a photocopy, sadly.
Oh, right.
The producer, of course, as producers do, had the... original.
Well, let's pull back a little bit to your earlier life. Tell me a little bit about your childhood, your mother and father, and what they did. I want to sort of lead towards how you followed this creative path.
I think that I wasn't particularly bright academically. I went to a grammar school in Norwich, in the town of Norwich. Mm-hmm. My father died when I was 10, so my mother had myself and my sister. When I was at that grammar school, there was a tradition there of doing Gilbert and Sullivan operettas as the sort of annual school show.
Yes.
And I remember painting the scenery. I was always interested in art. My mother was quite late in life, actually, took up painting and was actually quite talented, and I think she should have done more in her life, but she was too busy doing other things. Anyway, I painting the Tower of London, I think one of the members of staff, one of the teachers came up and complimented me on the painting and the scene of painting. And I was rather shocked by this. I think I almost turned around and said, oh, really? Do you really think so? And it was just one of those tiny little triggers, really.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is something I really enjoy. I'm really interested in theatre scenery. So I did lots of theatre work as I... got to the back end of my teens and my early 20s, well-known semi-professional theatre in Norwich called the Manor Market. Mm-hmm. Did a lot of work there, local rep for the local rep.
So this would have been in the evenings and weekends?
Yes, evenings and weekends, yes. Yeah. Still at school. Started when I was 15, 16, and went through... I went to America to do... a sort of theatre summer camp, that system there of summer camps they had there.
Yes.
There was quite a good theatre camp, so did three productions in the summer as the kind of guest
designer. So that would have been in the 50s?
That would
late
be
50s?
In 1960.
1960.
I went the summer of 1960. My mother, I think, was really quite scared of my interest in theatre and art. I think she was just... dutifully worried about my future security and all those things. And certainly the school I went to and the kind of school I went to were very, very mistrustful of any mention of art or art school. So when I eventually did say I wanted to go to art school, there was horror on the part of the school careers master.
Oh, really?
And some trepidation on the part of my mother, but her heart was in it and was extremely interested in it. And I think very courageously, really, for a rather... I'm making her seem rather timid, and she wasn't at all. No. She was quite strong. But she, I think very courageously in a way, allowed me to go to this disreputable place, which was Norwich Art School at that time.
Yes.
I mean, it was before, I think it was called the Summerson Committee that transformed art schools and gave a sort of recognition to their courses. And if they weren't up to scratch, they weren't allowed to run the course.
Right.
But this was before all that, and they really were considered rather loose, disreputable places. I went there, and I enjoyed it enormously.
Did you find a lot of connection with other people there? Did you find? But I guess if you had been working sort of with amateur theatre and so forth, you'd already made connections with that world anyway.
I had, and even at my grammar school, which wasn't in the least bit interested in art, there was, of course, an art, a couple of art masters, and so there was a little sort of fraternity within my grammar school. I stayed at Norwich Art School for a year, and then went to Hornsey as a painter, as a fine artist.
Hmm.
Which I didn't enjoy particularly. I'm not sure why, but I just made fewer connections there and spent all my time at a local theatre, the Mount View Theatre, which still exists, painting scenery there. So
you
painting was too solitary, really.
Right.
Theatre was
always...
You liked
the collectiveness of it all.
I did.
And I think you moved on to the Royal College.
And then I went to the Royal College. I used my theatre experience.
Big transformation, I would have thought.
Yeah.
They
ran a television and film design course, it was then.
They did, yes.
And so I applied for that. And my theatre experience, I guess, stood me in good stead, really. So I spent 3 happy years at the Royal College.
So you I know then you left, and I think you got a job assisting on Casino Royale, I think,
yes,
Michael Stringer.
Yes.
So that was your
film.
That was your entree. Well, that had so many people in it, I think, all trying to outdo one.
It did, and it was a complete mess, a total mess. I think the script, halfway through the script, was thrown out, really, and pages were issued the evening before telling you what you would shoot next day.
Really?
It was totally, totally
disorganized. So you were on that film, what were you primarily doing? You were... Just.
Well, I was making the tea, doing the blueprints. I was a junior draftsman. Our film art departments, design departments, are set up very like an architect's office, like an architect's office. And there's the bigger the film, the more rigid the structure.
Yeah.
And there's a designer, an art director, assistant, then draftsman in various stages of ability and experience and so on. And I was at the bottom of that hierarchy, absolutely at the bottom. But it was terrific education. I had just, without even being particularly aware of it, it kind of segued from theatre into film.
Yes.
But
because you could have easily have gone...
Yes.
As with many designers, go down the opera route or theatre route.
Yes,
and
yes.
stay there. You know,
yes.
There are many, very good... designers working in that field.
Indeed.
But you found the film more seductive, or you just...
I think it just happened, really. I think, I got into that course at the Royal College. You know, the important thing, I wanted to do a post-grad course.
Yeah.
I wanted to stay at art school. So I maximised my chances by applying for that. And so it was just a practical way forward, really.
With the various films that you've worked on over the year, and you've worked on some major films in the last 30 years.
Yes.
I suppose depending on the requirement, the number of people you'll need to work under you will be whatever is required. I mean, on the Potter films, for example, how many backroom people would you be in charge of for something
like
that?
Well, I suppose in the art department, there are 30, 35 people, and they included set decorator Stephanie McMillan
and
her
work
team.
With...
Quite
You've
a few times,
a lot. Is that unusual to have?
Well, of course, 10 years of films following hard one on the other kept us together, and we might have got split up. But it was a conscious choice to work together whenever we could. You know, it's a relationship I value very much indeed.
And her role is dressing.
She's the set decorator, so she's responsible for the furniture, the furnishings, the action props. You know, the things that the actors physically are involved with and handle. And she has great taste and an ability to tell the story, which is our first responsibility through the setting, the atmosphere, the props, and so on.
And of course, with the Potter films, the number, because you transfer from the reality of now to this surreal kind of world of Hogwarts, and everything goes with it, the kind of magical eclecticism of periods and so forth. And I suppose that must be a fantastic opportunity for anyone dressing a set.
Well, it was. It was an extraordinary...
And for you as a designer,
Yes. And also the fact that it was 8 films spread over 10 years, you had the chance to accumulate. We had the most amazing depository of extraordinary bits of furniture that we'd bought, that we'd made, and absolutely we owned them in many instances. Sometimes we'd hire very special pieces. But we had this wealth of material, of physical objects that were just beautiful, many of them. And so, the prop makers made very beautiful things. That also, the 8 films over 10 years allowed us to revisit things. The novels required that I think just 2 novels were published when we began. So we had no idea of requirements later on. And certain things in the novels required us to reinvent whole portions of Hogwarts, because the entrance that we had in the first and the lack of a sort of courtyard in front of that entrance didn't cater for the final film, when there was a big showdown and the Hogwarts itself and the main entrance were the focal point of storming it, really, of the battle for Hogwarts. So there were huge changes made along the way, and it was great to revisit things, and not just to ensure that it was telling the story, but actually to make things better.
Yes.
There were all kinds of compromises, things that were done in too much of a hurry, things that locations that we shot on, which we were obliged to feature, make part of the whole thing. Actually, their silhouette didn't help the silhouette of the whole thing at all. So there was a chance to go back and correct things as well, which is unique in film. You know, it's one compromise, one mistake, it's there forever.
Yeah.
Up there. And it's painful when you look at things that went wrong. So it is some gratification to be able to go back and correct.
Staying on the Harry Potters for a bit, I think one of the biggest transformations in cinema over the past decade is the advent of digital. And it kind of started in the editing room, really, with digital editing. And then then there were the kind of digital inserts into film, and most films these days seem to be shot on HD, or at least increasingly so.
Yes.
And even now the cinemas are projecting digitally, so it's fully integrated into the world of cinema. Now, I think when you started on the Potter films, that the amount of digital work was sort of fairly minimal compared with later, where you could literally design on a virtually do whatever was in your mind.
Yes.
I read somewhere you were saying that the sheer amount of textures you can create and change it almost at an instant would have taken so much set decoration time and painting that it's ridiculous. So how has that changed you as a designer, embracing that world? Because presumably you have to work with a lot of digital artists, and are you directing them through drawings that you would have done and references?
Yes.
And do you supervise the whole procedure?
Yes, we are. It was the 10-year history of the films absolutely covered that revolution. You know, it saw the whole revolution right through, really. And it was an amazing education. A lot of misconceptions on the way were sort of corrected. I'm thinking the Hogwarts exterior. Every time in the early films you saw the exterior of Hogwarts, it was a physical miniature, a huge physical miniature built on a big soundstage here, actually, at Shepperton. And in the Battle of Hogwarts, in the final film, the decision was taken to make that a digital model, and the physical one was scanned and then all but discarded, and the scan became the skeleton, the bare bones of a retextured digital Hogwarts. And I was skeptical about this, believing that physical miniatures must always be better, and the reality is it isn't at all. The digital model is so much better. The textures are very well and very carefully chosen. I was able to be involved with the company, the contractor that did it, a firm called Double Negative, and also with the visual effects chief. And as I said, we did take great pains to talk over architectural detail and make sure that it was hadn't got lost in the switch from the physical to the digital. So a lot of care taken to get it looking as real and as authentically detailed as possible. But it was, I absolutely accepted the digital future. Yes. in that one.
How much of the last film, the very last one, compared with the first one, would you say percentage-wise that was evident in that last film?
There's a huge amount in the last film. I wish I could quote the number of shots, hundreds and hundreds. Mm. A lot of digital compositing. Two physical elements shot separately and composited together. I mean, hundreds of shots of that kind. Actor shot against the blue screen, yes. Background shot in Scotland or wherever, yeah, else, and comped together later. And in the earliest films, there were just what used to be called matte paintings.
Yes, is that, yeah, like glass?
Paintings on glass, yep. Exactly. Even in the first Harry Potter film, I think that was being done digitally. They were digital, yeah, you know, photo composites and so on. But
yes.
So there were a few of those in the first film.
I interviewed last year Ken Adams. One of the points he made to me, and I'd be interested in your take on this, he said that you know, when the war room was created for the Strangelove film and the actors went on to that set, which was obviously a big set, it physically changed them. In terms of their characters, they became, he felt, much more of their characters. They were within this space. Now, many actors now have to perform against green screens and blue screens and whatever screens.
Yes.
And a lot of that would have happened in Harry Potter. And I just wondered what your view was, because presumably the earlier films had set pieces that they would physically be in, and I'm,
yes,
sure even in the last one. How is your view on that?
I think that observation is absolutely true. It's very disconcerting to walk onto an entirely blue or green set. And I have prejudice as befitting my age, I suppose, really. I loved the craft of filmmaking, of set design,
yeah,
and set manufacture as much as set design.
Yes.
It was the craft that really kept my interest. I didn't even care about film as such, maybe as much as I should.
You mean the passing of film?
I wasn't in love, yes, with film, yeah, as an art form, it, perhaps in the way that I should have been. I can see that I would have been much more passionate about architecture had I chosen to be an architect, or painting had I chosen to be that. But I loved the craft. Mm. I absolutely love. I love the designs on paper. I love the technical drawings. I was, I think, a rather good architectural draftsman in films. And then I loved the whole process with the carpenters, with the plasterers, and finally with the painters. That's,
yes,
where the joy is, really, in rendering the physical sets with texture and paint and you know, making them look 1,000 years old, or,
yeah,
and that's gone.
Those crafts have gone.
I think Harry Potter managed to inject new life because we needed both.
Yeah.
And they were such big films. There was so much work of all kinds required. We did actually manage to help young men have apprenticeships, fairly formal apprenticeships on those films, in those old traditional craft skills.
Right.
But of course, with the digital age, my regret is that there's less and less of that hands-on, mm, craftsmanship, which I enjoyed so much. But it's craft of a different kind. You still make the same,
yes,
the same value judgments. You have to be just as discerning, perhaps more discerning. So you are actually exercising the same skills.
Yes.
I'm just have this rather romantic, sentimental attachment for something that's past that I happen to enjoy,
yes,
hugely.
And I mean, in any sphere, in recording, for example, music recording, you know, there was a time when, you know, everything was recorded 48 track, whatever, you know, absolutely. And then suddenly there's a kind of retro feel that they want to go back and they start to record on four track and,
yes.
and try to do it completely live because yes. they don't want that perfection, that yes. sort of unreality. And I think probably maybe, you know, possibly in film that there's a, possibly sometimes a little bit of that. But if those crafts are going, it's not going to be as easy to recapture them.
It isn't. So. They do die. They do die very quickly. Mm. I think they've died much more in America, in California, than they have here in Europe. Those craft skills just went, really.
When the film is being shot on set, are you always present on the shoot or are you off doing the next setup?
Bit of both. Always there at first thing in the morning, just to see that everything is that's required is there, and particularly there a lot when a new set is being shot for the first time. You know, I'm there talking to the director, to the cameraman. I mean, there have been many conversations before, and they will have seen the set before, but nonetheless, there's a duty to be there.
And presumably there must be an enormous amount of pressure because, you know, shooting time is expensive and if a set's not ready,
yes.
does that fall on your shoulders? I mean, is that
But it's always ready.
It's always
ready. It's just, you are so conditioned to having it ready. Not being finished, it just isn't
just
an option. Just is not an option.
Now, you've been nominated 9 times for an Oscar and you've won 3. Which is pretty staggering. I think the first one was for Gandhi.
Yes.
Going back to that, when you hear them say, and the Oscar goes to, how did you feel?
Well, it's...
I take it you were there.
I was there. It's bizarre, isn't it? It's something the Americans enjoy hugely and unashamedly, and something that I, as a young British man, was a little... not overwhelmed by exactly, but a little... embarrassed by. I think you win one of those things, you could be win the election for the presidency the next day. They've set such store by it,
yeah,
and the publicity that surrounds it and the promotion that goes with it is so enormous. You know, it's just you want to say, hang on a minute, it's only a film set. You know, I did it, but somebody else could have done it just as well, just differently. And the exaggeration of the value of the thing just seems to me extraordinary. I've always enjoyed it. I've been back several times. I'm not
rather disappointed they don't
not churlish enough to say, you know, I don't set any store by this. I mean, design is, as with certain other disciplines, the Oscars tend to go in waves, don't they? And you know, the best film, the best actor, best director, those major awards will often carry with them the art direction award, the editing award, the sound award. And so I've been very fortunate in that I've been associated with some, you know, very important, well-known
Absolutely.
Films, really, and got swept along. And
after Gannett, does life change? I mean, do you get lots of offers?
Your stock really goes up. Yeah,
yeah.
You do get offers.
Yeah.
You do, yes. I was invited into offices of famous directors. And
so you're in that fortunate position of being able to pick and choose, hopefully.
Well, films are not that plentiful, are they, really? You know, you may have one or two or at the most 3 offers when you finish a film. And I've always regarded the quality of the film, the quality of the script, and the reputation of the director as absolutely paramount in governing my choice, really. I don't think I've ever chosen a film because it was a good design project, particularly.
Right.
It's always been more important. Every film needs
film
design. Every
yes,
film
of
needs
course
design.
It does, yes.
Every film, everything. So I kind of don't choose for subject or period or any of those things, just quality of script.
Actually, it just occurred to me whether working on 10 films in the sort of, as they call it, the franchise of Harry Potter, whether that enables you to be in the Guinness Book of Records or something. But I'm sure there's an Indian filmmaker that's made 50 films in a row.
Well, the Bond films, Ken's Bond films,
no.
but Peter Lamont's contribution was, you know,
constant.
Yeah, he must have made more than 10.
Oh, right, Bond. Okay, yes.
And he worked with Ken. He worked under Ken
in
the early days, yeah. That Strange Love set really is extraordinarily famous, isn't it? It's the most famous image in film.
I think that when one of the presidents, when he became president, he asked whether he could go to the wardroom,
in the
thinking that that was the real thing.
Yeah.
It's a set that everybody sort of... I think the thing about Ken Adams is that he's sort of come full circle. Many, many young designers, both in the world of film design and architecture and graphic design, everyone suddenly looked at that work again, because I think there was a time when the Bond films particularly, when maybe people were not so interested, but it has a huge interest now, that early stuff.
Actually, yes, wasn't it? But it was a two-way traffic, I think, really.
Yes, I think there are a lot of very current architects that I think Zaha Hadid's work often reminds me of some of these things.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to you. Are there any areas of film production design that you would like to embrace that you haven't? I mean, I know that you did, I think, your, one of your very early films was a space film, Saturn.
Yes.
That's the only
space
film.
Yeah, science fiction film.
And obviously things have moved on a lot since
then
in terms of, you know...
I would like to do that, but I think I really do mean what I said. The subject isn't particularly important.
Mm. As you said just now, it's the story and the director.
Yeah, I'd love to do a musical. I think that would be on the kind of liberty that the Harry Potter fantasy afforded. Musicals are also have an air of unreality about them, which must be liberating in a way that would affect the designer and be very enjoyable.
Yes, that's true.
So
I'd
quite like to do a musical.
Yes, I mean, that takes me back to another Potter, actually, Dennis Potter. His film work with the musical content, which became Rather, and I think they did make a rather unsuccessful Hollywood run, which was awful. I think that was the first time when music was used in a very surreal way within a television production.
Yeah, I think I'd just as soon be a good painter or a good architect.
Do you paint? I mean, do you have time to paint?
No,
do you ever
it's all for the film, really. It's kind of all consuming. And
so what other interests do you have outside? Do you get a chance to do other things? And if so, do you have any other passions that sort of really occupy you?
My passion right now are my grandchildren, which is a fairly predictable thing to say, isn't it? I think grandparents often get swept away by the...
So you're not one of these with a car collection or...
I don't have a car collection. Sort of, I do have a tiny little cottage in North Norfolk, which I enjoy very much.
Yes.
Very much so. I really do keep working, and I'm frightened of not working. It's such a habit with me. I'm absolutely very unsure of what life would be like without work.
I guess the last 10 years must have been I assume they went very fast.
They did go very fast,
and
we went from one film to another,
and
extremely fast. Yeah. It is a blur. Yeah.
Well, we're coming to the end now. I just wondered what advice you would give to anyone wanting to follow in your footsteps, a young student coming out of art college that's wanting very much to get into the film business, because I know the film business is truncated a lot. It's much tougher now, and as you say, many of these crafts are going. You've got to be very aware of the digital world. What would you say to them?
The practicalities of getting in... certainly becoming a designer is, I think that's dependent on relationships that you formed, really. Get as much experience you can, get any experience you can, working on films, on music videos, on commercials, in theatre, you do whatever you can. But then, as I say, when it comes to getting your first design job, that's a huge step, and a step that lots of deserving people don't actually get to take, really. And in my experience, my own break came from relationships, really, or a relationship with Richard Attenborough, and Richard Attenborough's producer at that time. And my first break came with a relationship with a very good designer, John Barry, who directed Saturn III.
Yes.
And he wrote it, that very first film I ever did. Unsatisfactory, unsuccessful, and John didn't actually finish the film. But John did the first ever Star Wars. He did A Clockwork Orange, He did the first ever Superman, which was actually very well designed, and the first one was much better than the others.
Yes.
He was a considerable figure, a very special designer.
He died quite
young. And he died at age 43.
Yes,
he did.
That's right.
So my relationship with him, my relationship with Richard Attenborough, my relationship with Terry Clegg, who was Attenborough's producer, who did The Elephant Man, it was all driven by relationships. So cultivate professional relationships, because that's where the opportunity will come in film, I'm sure.
Well, I'm sure after
So that's
this,
practical you, advice.
I'm sure you have a lot of people sort of phoning you up and asking you to cultivate some relationships with them. Stuart Craig, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike.